O Holy Lord, bless these words as they go forth from one heart to another and multiply them in their effect. Thank you to our elders and to you for this wonderful opportunity to share some thoughts with you this morning. For my entire life, I have been sensitive to those who are suffering. As an adult, that has been a passion, and of more recent years, a mission to make a difference. When I observe our world on a personal level, my own precious family and friends that I love so dearly, what I see in varying degrees from person to person are very concerning levels of stress, fear, anxiety, along with a host of physical illnesses and chronic conditions with their related suffering. Because of my youngest brother, this passion and this mission have been ignited. I am compelled to speak to you today about something that not only I, but he would want you to know. David suffered with just about every aspect of emotional and mental stress and physical illness in his life. Although most of his adult years, like everyone else, we believed and just accepted that that's the way it is. David and I were extremely close, and I tried my best to support him from a distance via the telephone through his suffering, most especially after our mother moved here so I could care for her because he was no longer able to do that. That left David pretty much alone in El Paso. He suffered with significant physical health problems, but the emotional ones were even greater, which I now know were the primary causes contributing to the physical ones. It was heart-wrenching for both of us. He had all sorts of doctors and a psychiatrist, but as time went on, he only got worse. Finally, through what I consider the grace of God, I learned and taught him something that would make a difference for him, just as it had for me, although by that time his physical condition had deteriorated too far to make a difference in that respect. Nevertheless, in his last few months of life, David was at last mentally, emotionally, and spiritually at peace within himself, with God, and with life and death. He died gently and peacefully 15 months ago. This topic of suffering is far too vast to cover in one sermon, but I hope to bring to light at least what research and practice are showing as a basic reason for suffering and something that most of you probably have never even heard about. Even better, though, I want to share with you how to begin the journey to freedom from suffering. I want you to leave with a sense of anticipation and hope. Life does not have to be this way. So if you are presently suffering or someone you love is suffering, there is hope. There truly is a way to experience peace and joy in this life, regardless of the circumstances that life brings you. Suffering really is optional in most and perhaps all cases. Jesus' wilderness experience is going to show us why I can make such a bold statement. In your bulletin, you have the text for the scripture reading today. I want to quickly point out just a few things. To the Jews, numerically speaking, the number 40 did not literally mean 40. It was a code, so to speak, that meant a long time, and it also was their way of saying that something was a period of probation, trial, and/or chastisement. The word wilderness was a metaphor, When you combine all of these hidden meanings, what you get is a very long fast that is a period of probation, trial, and or chastisement for the purpose of emptying one's whole self out, laying it bare, letting it all go until there is nothing but emptiness. Now we know the purpose of the fast, but what was the reason for the whole experience? To answer that, we must examine who, or more precisely, what this Satan character is that just shows up out of nowhere, in the middle of nowhere, to tempt Jesus. In Mark, it says that Jesus was tempted by Satan, with a capital S. Matthew and Luke use the term the devil, lowercase d. Are they all three referring to the same thing? In the Hebrew language, the word Satan means adversary, opposer, one to accuse or question. In Hebrew, this word was used as a job description, but not as a name for anything. And get this, in the Bible, even God at times fills that job description. So God, at times, is the Satan. The word devil is a non-specific term that referred to the kind of evil that is a hostile and destructive force, but it was never used as a proper name for anything. So given those explanations and definitions, we must conclude that tells us that Jesus was opposed by a hostile or destructive force that was something other than a being of some sort. And honestly, if you stop to think about who in the Bible poses the greatest opposition to God and spreads the most hostile destruction about the earth, it is not a fallen angel and his army of demons, as we have, many of us have been taught and believe, but rather we humans. Now, I'd like you to hang on to that thought as we proceed through this lesson. Did the word drove capture your attention in Mark 1, verse 12? It really caught my attention. Do you know how many times I've heard this story and I never thought about that? Doesn't it make you wonder why Jesus, of all people, would have to have been coerced into going to do something that God wanted him to do? So much so that the Spirit had to make him go. Did anybody ever point that out to you, or did you ever realize that before? I didn't. Was he not wanting to submit to God? And why was it so important to God that it would appear to have been mandatory? Let's see what we can discover. As we observe this situation, the first and most obvious thing is Jesus fasting, obviously for spiritual reasons. But this is not a lesson on fasting, but one to uncover the true identity of the Satan and the relevance of this entire experience of suffering. Before we dig into that, I'm going to ask you to try and set aside what you've been taught and what you have thought you knew about this very familiar story, and open your mind to consider another possibility that you may never have contemplated. The Spirit of God within you recognizes truth. So if you listen to your heart, you will discern if what you hear is truth. I would like to suggest that this wilderness scenario might be seen as an allegory for something mankind throughout the ages has tried to explain in many different ways. That is the true identity of this opposer. Discovering that has everything to do with the actual reasons for and the outcome of a wilderness experience, not only for Jesus, but for us too. If you are old enough, you will remember those cartoons that had the little angelic character fluttering around over here and the little demonic character over here on the shoulder of this very confused person with this going on here and this going on here, and they didn't know what to do. Well, that may sound funny, but it's a perfect illustration of double-mindedness that's mentioned in your two James passages. We've all experienced this, not literally, hopefully not, but most definitely figuratively. This illustration is the personification of the two voices that actually do speak to us. And I believe without the shadow of a doubt that this is what Jesus' wilderness experience centered around, the resolution of double-mindedness, which is the submitting to God and the resisting of the devil. In the wilderness experience, Jesus submitted to God as he fasted and prepared to face the opposer. By the end of the story, we know that he had achieved single-mindedness by the way that he resisted and responded to the temptations posed by the opposer. Our two passages in James provide the perspective about double-mindedness for our consideration in Jesus' wilderness experience and our own. So what does it mean to be double-minded when we only have one mind? What is this talking about? What this is talking about is the mind in our head and the spiritual heart. Both have voices with which they communicate with us. Our spiritual heart is the source of the gentle, wordless voice of the Spirit of God. It is represented by the little cherub in our illustration. It is found within us, not the little cherub, but the voice of our heart. It's found within us in a place that the Bible refers to as our heart. Our spiritual heart is the essence of God. It's our true self. And it is where the Spirit dwells in us. It is our consciousness, the seat of wisdom, the place of knowing. It is a quiet and calm place where there is peace and joy. It is our eternal self. Because it is of God, it is only and completely rooted in love. Because what is God? Love. This heart should not be confused with our blood-pumping organ, but there is research today suggesting that perhaps our physical heart and our spiritual heart are somehow tied together. It is through our spiritual heart that God communicates with us and we with God. But this communication is not with literal words as we know them, but with something higher, a form of subtle energy that the ancient ones knew and Eastern peoples today still know and practice, but the Western world threw this off centuries ago. The Bible describes the Spirit's communications as groanings too deep for words. If we are ever going to be doing fine by becoming single-minded, then we are going to have to get reconnected to our true self and our wisdom, which I will refer to henceforth simply as our heart. Jesus knew this, or at least he did by the time he completed his required assignment. He likely also knew that achieving that would not be easy or painless, which could explain the resistance for having this experience. The other voice is one you will recognize because it is the voice in your head that never stops talking, and it seems to know and be in charge of everything. This is the voice of double-mindedness. If you pay attention, you will observe it arguing with itself by taking both sides of an issue. That certainly is double-minded. Well, this is the voice represented by the little demon in our illustration. You will see why as we go along. In psychology, this voice in our head is referred to as the ego or the psyche. For our purposes, I will refer to it as either ego or the voice. We are all familiar with the term ego, which we think of as our tendency to think more highly of ourselves than we ought to. However, this is only a tiny part of what the ego is and does. Let me interject here that we should not confuse the egoic part of our brain with our intellect, And actually, the ego will take over our intellect sometimes. While both are part of our brain, they are entirely different in function and purpose. Psychology tells us that the ego is an archaic program in our brain that was originally for the purpose of protecting our ancient ancestors from being eaten by wild beasts by inducing the fight or flight response. Today, however, we don't generally have those kinds of dangers, so the ego responds to the adrenaline rush within us instead with new uses for itself in protecting us. The ego believes it is supremely important, knows everything, and wants us to believe that too, so that we will obey what it says. The biggest problem is that the ego thinks it knows things it doesn't really know. Since it can have no experiences of its own, it makes things up for what it doesn't know by creating all kinds of stories and possibilities to present the most convincing case to us. It tries to convince us that we can't really trust others, while it is actually what we cannot trust. It doesn't do this on purpose. As a matter of fact, it doesn't even know it is doing it. It's just a program that's running that's designed to protect us. It listens to us tell it what we want and follows its programming to protect us and tries to control the world outside our head by creating a world that pleases us inside our head, which, of course, is only an illusion. No wonder it is so confused, and then we are too if we give heed to it. Because it is designed to protect, it is rooted in fear. Everything it says has an element of fear woven into it, which you will recognize if you pay close attention. The ego is often referred to as the false self because it convinces us that it is our identity. But it is nothing more than a bunch of thoughts, and most certainly not who we are. How do we know? Who is capable of observing it? Can it observe itself? Or can you observe it? And can you observe yourself? You can, because you are the one who has consciousness, and you are the one that is real, not the ego. So, if we are going to instead listen to the wisdom of our heart, which doesn't talk with words or make all the noise that the ego does, how can we hear it? And how can we be sure that what we do hear is the voice of our heart? How can we tell the difference between these two? To do that, there are a couple of questions that you can ask yourself about the thoughts that you're hearing. Is this thought expressed from words in my head or from a sense of knowing from somewhere inside? Are these words I hear fear-based or love-based? Now, check how these thoughts make you feel. Do you feel contracted or open? Do they make you feel restricted or free? Do they make you feel conflicted or harmonious? Do they make you feel confused or clear? I have prepared a handout that you can take at the door. I've recruited three lovely young assistants that will be standing at the three doors, so you can't get out of here without passing by them. And they'll give you the handout if you want it. But on that handout, there's a chart that contrasts the heart and the ego and gives you the ways to recognize the voice that you're hearing. I mentioned my brother David. He was a prime example of living by the voice in his head, his false self, his ego. He didn't know it at the time. I didn't know it. Most of us don't. His true self, though, was so loving and creative and funny, and I miss him. For most of his adult life, His true self got lost in suffering from double-mindedness that caused severe depression, extreme anxiety, paranoia, high blood pressure, a stroke in his 40s, and a massive heart attack that took his life at 60. Because of a divorce that he did not want and the estrangement of his only child who he loved so dearly, he lived alone, heartbroken. His house was a museum memorializing a life that no longer existed. He filled the house to overflowing, trying to fill the hole in his heart. For nearly 17 years, he lived with anger and grief that he just couldn't get past because of the voice. His life was a perfect example of creating a living hell. That hell will even kill you. Doesn't this voice sound like the devil to you? It sure does to me. And what about all the people who inflict their suffering upon others, both intentionally and unintentionally, thus spreading the blight of the ego? That would be every single one of us, just to greater or lesser degrees. No one is exempt, and only the ego would stand in judgment of anyone for what they did through their suffering. How many in this room have suffered or are suffering because of something someone else who was suffering did? Who has inflicted suffering on others as an effect of their own suffering? When it reaches the levels of devastating lives and taking lives, does this not sound like the evil that pervaded mankind since the beginning of time? Where does it end? The Bible equates sin with suffering. Now, I'm not fond of the word sin because in my background, it carried too many connotations that we are inherently evil, and I believe that we are inherently good because we are of God and His Spirit dwells in us. But if we needed to identify a source and a cause of sin and suffering, isn't it beginning to sound rather like the ego might be highly suspect? It does to me. There is good news, though. It doesn't have to be this way. There really is another option. That's exactly what those two passages in James are talking about. That of being single-mindedness, by listening to and following our heart while we resist listening to the voice, the devil, who will then flee from us. To do that, though, we must learn how to tune in to our heart and how to tune out to our ego. In doing those two things, we will find our freedom from the tyranny of the ego and in its place the peace and joy that is truly heaven on earth. When difficulties come, and they always will in this life, we will be able to face and handle them with strength, courage, grace, and wisdom without losing even one ounce of freedom, peace, and joy. This is precisely how my brother David was able to leave this life peacefully after all those years of torment. And once you have found that, you will have to share it just as I have to, so it will spread and the world will change. With all of that said, though, let's not judge the ego, because that would be egoic. Whether we like it or not, it provides us with opportunities through suffering to learn things that suffering can teach us, and if we will let it, can be an incredible teacher. In itself, the ego is neither good nor bad, it's just a program. It is only the outcome of the voice that we choose to heed that could be considered good or bad. The outcome of single-mindedness can only ever be good because it is love. The idea of good or bad, right or wrong, black or white, this or that, is the construct of the ego. As it judges, it separates, and it diminishes and dismisses. There are important lessons to be learned for our spiritual growth in every experience we have. But the ego, if we heed it, only wants to judge and dismiss, and that deprives us of experiencing the fullness of every experience so we can learn and grow. By listening to and following our heart, we will discover rich learning and growth opportunities in every experience through seeking to find all there is, both positive and negative. Both are teachers. Through the heart, we learn to value all experiences without judging them. I think you will agree from your own life that it is through experiencing the most painful things, the ones where we have to stretch ourselves beyond what we think our limits are, to understand the seemingly incomprehensible, that is where we come out on the other side, having grown the most spiritually, making us better human beings and bringing us closer to God. When we do that, love is our teacher. When we don't allow ourselves these full experiences because we let the ego hold us captive in fear, judgment, and dismissing, it is our loss, and we will, at some other time, have to have another experience until we learn that lesson. I believe that is exactly what Jesus was working through in the wilderness experience. By the end of his 40 days of trial and chastisement in the wilderness, of emptying himself out of his ego, he was ready to be filled up with God's love, wisdom, and peace, ready to face and conquer the opposer. He did that, and we can too. I hope by now you are thinking, well, that sounds conceivable, and I sure could do without all this suffering and sure could use some peace and joy, but how? Well, you do it the same way that you would walk 1,000 miles, by taking the first step, and with purpose and determination, the next and the next until you reach the destination. That 1,000 miles would be your journey through the wilderness of double-mindedness to your destination of single-mindedness. It's long and it's hard. It's uphill and down with all sorts of difficulties and obstacles. But you just keep putting one foot in front of the other until one day you come to the top of a hill and there is your destination right in front of you. There's a pair of shoes you must have on your feet before you can start walking, though, or you will never get there. One shoe is the awareness of the voice. The other shoe is accessing your heart to hear its quiet wisdom over the ego's raving madness. To put on the first shoe, begin to observe your ego. Just notice what it's saying. Give a hard listen. What is it saying right now? Possibly something that's making you feel afraid of what you are hearing? Remember that it isn't you and it isn't real and it always wants to keep you in fear. That's how it holds you captive. Remember, it isn't real and can only spew out thoughts from its programming. As your awareness causes you to begin to recognize yourself being led by ego, you will begin resisting it. You may even amaze yourself by responding with something like, "Oh, ego, bye-bye." The more you resist it, that's when you truly are moving down the road toward the destination of single-mindedness. You will be amazed at just how fine your life is going to be without your ego's help. We will put on the other shoe momentarily as together we learn about and practice contemplative prayer. It has been said that within each of us is a great lover, our true self, and a great wolf, the ego. The one that we feed is the one that will grow. We will not stop feeding the wolf inside until we recognize it for what it is. Today, it is my hope that if you've been feeding this great wolf that you didn't recognize as a wolf, but now you do, that you will instead began feeding the great lover that resides quietly, patiently, and peacefully inside, which is your spiritual heart, your true self, your God in you. If that is the case, then please don't delay your journey to freedom. Your life will forever change for the better, and not only yours, but every life that your life touches. Learn we must. We don't get a choice about that, though we do get to choose for how long and how hard we will suffer before we are willing to have our own wilderness experience, to become single-minded, and to finally bring an end to all of this self-induced suffering, because the opposer has once and for all been subdued. In this new quietness, we can now hear the gentle whisper of our heart. In single-minded union with the all that is, the great I am, we have found that heaven on earth. That, dear friends, is why Jesus and we have no choice but to sooner or later have our wilderness experience.